Welcome back to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast, coming to you from the Honest Luxury Conference in London. I'm Sean Borstrock, and if you missed the first half of this episode with Biju Abiola and Sam Bompas, you may have missed Sam Bompas boldly redefining luxury over a custard cream, which according to him is perfectly paired with the history of South London and the side of emancipation. But as the biscuit crumbs settle, we're diving even deeper. Joining me once again are Sam and Biju to tackle the big questions, like what really makes something luxury today, why relationships matter most, and why the best stories are sometimes shaped by a bit of friction, memory, and maybe even a chewy cookie. Let's get stuck in.
So, Biju, so this might be a bit confrontational. So you're in a, you know, Cartier mass produce a lot of this stuff. We were talking the other day about a $20 million piece of jewelry, but they also produce, you know, like, I don't know, a tennis bracelet that is £15,000. And that £15,000, the quality of the tennis bracelet is not necessarily reflected in the materials. Because you could buy a tennis bracelet that, if it's, I don't know, 3 carats, that might be £1,000 or £2,000. How would you distinguish, and I know you're not talking for Cartier, how would you distinguish those levels in terms of perceptions of luxury? Because coming in and buying your $20 million piece of jewelry is a very different thing to buying your your $15,000 or pounds tennis bracelet, but you're saying you're selling that same experience. You're not getting
it. It's a very different experience. And I cannot speak at all about the brand or experience. However, if I step back from the price range differences that the houses offer, we have, all the brands have people that are very dedicated to cultivating clients of a certain tier of spend, right? Sure. So those people have direct access to their sales associates. They have them come over to their homes for birthday parties. They bring them on their yachts. They actually form real friendships with these people so that when it's time to buy, it's almost like you're buying from a friend. That's another thing. Luxury, I think, is relationship as well, right? Because you're buying from someone you trust. A mentor of mine often says this, when someone comes into the boutique or to your brand, so let's use Chanel. Someone comes to Chanel for the first time, it's because they've heard of Chanel. It's aspirational, something they want. That's the first time they come. When they come back the second time, they're coming because of the relationship that they built with maybe Sean, their sales associate, right? So it goes from the brand to actually the relationship that you build with the client. So to answer your question, that experience that $20 million client is having is very different from the client who is at the $15,000 range.
Yeah.
But it's all about building that relationship. Because guess what? You have people who spend $15,000 today and in about 10 years can spend $20
million. Yeah.
So it's all about,
well, that's a good client. That's a good place to be.
I'm just saying that it's definitely about building those relationships in such a way that you trust the person enough to spend that amount of money at the end of the day. It sounds ridiculous, but I've seen it with my own eyes.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just emoting with that as well. And because I have some friends who have, they're so wealthy, they've got so much money, and it's forever as well, because they own companies that are just kicking off money and will kick off money forever. I would not trade places with them ever, because every time they have an interaction with anyone around them or their friends around them, they are sort of questioning what the reason this interaction is happening. They're not convinced they have any friends at all. They're very lonely in many ways. What I see them being most interested in with their dispersal of this, frankly, pretty much unlimited wealth is, having a good time and a meaningful time. And also having relationships they feel are real in some way. If that's the thing that they're most looking for, it's not a question of money to be able to have
exactly.
That. Maybe that wealth makes those relationships much, much harder.
And that's where relationships with your sales associate become, sometimes they become your most trusted friends, like genuinely your most trusted friends, because they know how much money you have and they're not, I mean, of course they're there to sell you something, but I have instances where, or I've heard of instances where, you know, they'll come to your children's wedding at some point, and that's where they build those close circle of friends, is in people who cater to them, whether you'll hear people who are very close to their household staff, right? Or people who are close to, it just is because to that point, who can you trust? But anyway, I don't want to segue into like money.
But part of it is about money. It's interesting that this conversation is becoming much more about emotion. Luca was talking earlier, and his presentation was very much not only, but stats driven. So how you differentiate, you know, between the experience that's provided by the by the brand. And he gave two examples. One was Hermes, and the other, or three, one Hermes, Loro Piana and Prada being in the top 10, Prada 9 out of 10 and the other two 10 out of 10 in terms of experience. But that, I haven't spoken to him about that yet, but to me, that makes absolutely no sense. It's like, how is that experience measured in terms of the customer and the product, when the cost, you know, the product MS, yeah, might be good, but how do you get a 10 out of 10? You know, that's a ceiling, 10 out of 10. Why am I saying that? Oh yeah, just going back to this emotional thing.
Do you want ways to quantify experience?
Yes, exactly. There we go. How do we quantify the experience?
We often have to do that because people spend a lot of money with us to build experiences, and they want some rationale for it. So there are lots of different methodologies to do that. Like ultimately, it comes down to like, are you earning revenue for your brand?
When we talk about experiences, right? Sorry, is that actually, when you walk into a boutique where they are charging a lot more money, you might not have the best customer experience, believe it or not.
Yeah.
They are typically, I'm not saying typically, sometimes they are not the nicest, right? They know that there are people waiting in lines to come in and shop. And then you go to another boutique where they're selling things that are slightly mid-tier, relatively speaking, and it's the very best experience that you would have, right? So a lot of people, like, where are you going to return to? You're probably going to go back to that boutique where you didn't have the best experience because society is telling you that you have to have that product, which is ridiculous, right? So if I think of the process of getting an Hermes bag, do we even want to go there, right? But people are buying tons and tons of things they don't need just to qualify for a bag. So a lot of it is emotional, but a lot of it is psychological as well.
Unless you've got the money to just go and buy them. Well,
because even if you have the money to go and buy, sometimes they won't sell it to you. It's not about money. It really depends. About them deciding that you are worthy of having one of their bags.
Yeah.
Can friction be a luxury as well? Oh. And like, you know, we hear a lot about like how important comfort is, but like actually comfort can be quite tedious after a while. And, you know, in terms of going through the gauntlet to get on the list and get approved and jump through the hoops, that in itself is a sense of achievement. And I think the friction, you know, it used to be very high status to have very soft hands because it meant you didn't work. But now with soft hands, it means you don't work out. it means are you really paying attention? Can friction? But of course, that also leads us on to like luxury as a means of being able to transfer across different classes and in terms of your experiences and be able to transfer easily. So you hear like sort of King Charles's class tourism, where he goes to Romania and lives the life of a 19th century peasant. What larks! Like, you know, which all the locals in the village that he owns, which only has one road in and out and has no Wi-Fi because he likes it to have no Wi-Fi, are incredibly frustrated because they would really like to have a high-speed internet connection there. But for King Charles, this is his personal luxury is being able to have the freedom to step into this world. But of course, the people who are there can't step out of it. Sorry, it's not very it's not a very kind opinion, but like luxury is also an elite.
Yeah. Actually, sorry, can it's I just, I think experience. Another thing about luxury, this idea of supply and demand that you bring up, right, which we're calling friction, which is if everything is accessible to everyone. So I personally, as a consumer, once something becomes, I won't say a brand, there's a brand that has four stripes on it. You know, once upon a time, not a lot of people knew about that brand. And then all of a sudden it was everywhere. I will never wear that brand again, right? Like, so that is a personal decision of mine.
Yeah.
So you have people who once it becomes mass, and it's not a classist thing at all. It's just like once something becomes super, personal example, I'm not on Instagram. Why? Because everyone's on Instagram, right? So it's kind of dumb too, because I'd probably make a lot more money if I was on Instagram. But my point is like some people, luxury for them is truly just not doing what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
And for some people, luxury is this idea of I can get something that other people can't get. And no matter the cost of getting that thing, if I get it, then it proves that there's something worthy, like I am worthy of that status. So it really, again, goes back to this idea of the emotional / psychological feeling of luxury.
Interesting. This morning, the four panel members that I spoke to, that I mentioned earlier, their luxury thing was time, which it doesn't matter what I think. What do you think?
I mean, everyone's got time, right? And the worst thing I heard about time was, there were two people speaking, one employed the other. And he said, you know, everyone's got the same 8 hours in the day, but you work for me, so I've got eight of yours. So whose time are they buying?
Yeah.
Where does it come from around the world? What are the actual implications of that time that they're buying in the sort of global capitalism? How do they feel about that? Also, you know, sort of going on to what one thing I'd love to see, one thing that makes me really excited is, I spent so long getting excited about food and ephemeral experiences. And I read many years ago that this is like a sort of maybe gendered thing, that as men's testosterone falls as they age and they head towards a new adolescence, they start getting back into collecting. And I remember when I was much younger, having loads of like interesting things and bits of string and toy cars in my pocket. And I was like, will I ever get there? Will I ever start like collecting things again? And will I get into stuff? And I've recently started getting into loads of stuff and collecting loads of things. And then I was like, how can collecting be cool now? Because isn't it just like a factor of like a high-speed internet connection and a pile of cash? Because you used to have to really work hard to find quite obscure things, and now actually it's becomes a lot easier. But I'm really interested in people that have really weird, obscure collections that they've invested a lot of time into. Like there's I know a couple called Caroline and Robin Weir, and their house is like the Batcave of ice cream, and they eat vanilla ice cream every day because it's the best. And you go into their normal house and it's floor to ceiling with ice cream paraphernalia. Wow. And I find it completely fascinating and joyful and inspiring that they've dedicated so much of their time and so much of their resources to putting this beautiful collection together.
Right. So Luca, you can provide the cones for that family. Luca's family, they own a gourmet ice cream cone manufacturer in Italy. Oh yeah, you guys should chat.
Let's chat.
Yeah, you should chat. Okay, so the time thing. So what, luxury and time? Is that a thing for you?
I will say that I'm very, when it comes to time, we can never get it back again, right? So someone gives you $1,000, you can go and get it back. Someone gives you 10 minutes. They have a finite time on earth. So actually, to me, time is more valuable than money, genuinely speaking. So even when I say yes to doing things, like yes to being here,
yeah,
it's a conscious decision that this is where I want to spend this versus somewhere else. So I definitely think that time is something that we don't think of. And I'm also chief of staff. which yeah. means that I'm constantly thinking of the value of the time that we're spending on each conversation, each topic. You know, it's kind of, what do you think?
I'm just like,
so like I'm always thinking about time as far as just like, I hate wasting it. So whether or not it ties to luxury, again, I think it's just this idea of like everything is being defined as luxury. Health is a luxury, right? Like being able to get up and walk is a luxury. So there are many things that we can define as luxury, but if we're speaking purely in terms of goods, services, et cetera, I'm not sure. Craftsmanship, right? The longer it takes to make something, the more expensive it is because you're paying for the labor of the people who are putting time into making it.
Well, interesting you said that. So Richard, who's an embroiderer, was saying it could take him 6 months or 5 years to make a piece that he's embroidering, and he would never be able to charge for that because 6 years. Anyway, so moving on from the time, I was just thinking about 18th century and connoisseurs and the Grand Tour and this idea of collecting, because they were traveling the world collecting and coming back with these amazing finds. And that was that's a perception of luxury, which is very different. What do you think about that notion of discovery and luxury and that experience, which you don't get if you're in London, if you're in Tokyo, if you're in Paris, wherever, you will find all the same stores on the same kind of street selling the same things that they're selling in each city. The Grand Tour personifies something very different as an experience.
I think it goes back to that? Memory, right? Yeah. Like it's like the memory of. So you'll have people who, yes, there is a, I keep using Hermes, I don't know why, because I can't use my brand, but like, yes, there's an Hermes boutique in every city, but I'm in London and I'm in London for my daughter's graduation and I want to buy something from here that will remind me of this moment in time.
Yeah.
And in my life. So I think it's this idea of the memory of a thing, or this idea of when you're talking about they would go and get things that people had never seen before. So that's one way of it. And that's what we're talking about, supply and demand, things that people don't have. But then there's also this idea of marking the moment, the memory of the moment. You know, why do you buy wedding bands? Why do you buy, you know, now brides buy their groom's watches. Like, why do we buy things for people? It's to mark the time, to mark the occasion. It's really ultimately about a memory that we're trying to preserve. And that's also the beauty of it. When people come to us, they're coming to us to celebrate love. They're coming to us to celebrate typically a happy moment in their life. And how do we make that happy moment last forever? Or as long as, you know, as you, every time you look at that thing, you feel a certain sense of nostalgia because it reminds you of a happy time in your life.
Yeah, man, I love that idea as well. It's like, you know, show and tell is always a really good way of storytelling. I was actually trying to bring an ice cream shaped potato shaped ice cream mold today. I couldn't find it. Just in terms of like concretizing storytelling. As we're talking with Richard the embroiderer earlier, we're talking about Victor Hugo's house in Guernsey, which is publicly accessible. You can look it up. The entire ground floor is carpeted. Well, it's actually just floor to ceiling tapestries. It's extraordinary. And these are all scraps and bits and bobs he found in the markets in Guernsey when he was exiled there from France, stitched together and coated the interiors, very dark, heavy interiors. And then it goes up to sort of like light modernism where he'd write. But I'm always amazed when you see the fountain pen of Victor Hugo. And I don't know whether it's a nice fountain pen or like, you know, the equivalent, the biro of the day. It sort of doesn't really matter. Like, I love the idea that this object, you know, has been of importance to this person who has then worked on these bits of work. I always find that completely extraordinary. And you know, with things like the V&A on the East Bank opening up their warehouses as well and exposing those elements of and functionalities of museumography. I think it's an interesting time. It's an interesting time for objects.
Yeah, great.
So I was also going to even say, if we think of labubus. Anybody know what a labubu is? Okay. Like, labubu is a luxury now, right? Like, it was 17 pounds at Harrods 3 weeks ago. People started fighting for it. And so now I just bought a labubu for 49 pounds. Because I really wanted one, because all of a sudden, kind of contradicting myself, because I said, I don't like what people like, but I'm buying this because I want to get it from my little nieces because I want to prove that I'm a cool aunt, right? Like, look, I got you something your friends can't even get. But it's this idea of like something can go from not being a luxury to being a luxury overnight because you can't get it. And that's where premiums come in. And that, I think, is this idea of like, they are the ugliest things I've ever seen, but they are now considered a luxury. Well, just had to put that out there for Lulu's.
Thanks.
Anyone and I can tell you where to get one if you want
one. Are you
one
selling yours?
Mine is now £150. Yeah, right.
Okay. Let's, anyone have any questions? Okay. Let's, should we? I have
no idea what. Labubu. There are these little ugly furry animals from PopSmart. You can Google it. If someone could put one up on the screen too, that would be great. Yeah, but they're little like keychains that people now put on their Birkin bags. I'm not going to put on my Birkin because, you know, no. But I'm tempted. I put my goddaughter, but now I might use it just because. Yeah.
Okay.
A Labubu. There you go.
Okay, there you go. So one at the back and then Gordon and then...
So thank you, Sam. Thank you, Viju. I have a question in regards to storytelling that you've been mentioning as well. What's next, Sam said. Do you think filmmaking is the next thing? I look back at experiential branding, for example, and we see the big fashion houses going out to where the affluent individuals are, opening stores, coffee shops, hotels. We started with the Italians, Armani back then, 12 years ago. Then the French came late, but they came full on. Cheval Blanc, Dior opened even in Dallas, Cafe. So a lot going on in that sense. But I also see there's been about 5 movies by Gatsby. And the last one collaborates with Miu Miu in Prada, for example. A lot of interest generated by everyone. It almost feels like cheap marketing for them because they didn't do much, I think. House of Gucci. Another example, I think they just opened archives. LVMH has invested in, I think it's called 22 Montagne Studios. I will be misleading here, but they invested in that. Do you think filmmaking is coming, really, as part of this storytelling?
That's a great, great question, but I absolutely think it's how do you, the further away you get from the generations that created these brands originally, how do you build that sense of, because again, Gen Z is like the best and the worst generation at the same time. Like they don't care, right? So how do you make them interested in something that their parents were once interested in? And it's this idea of building nostalgia and building the sense of, oh, wow. Like if Hermes, they just did a podcast, How I Built This. There's this How I Built This podcast where the Hermes team finally opened up and shared a lot about the story behind Hermes. I never even knew about the story of Hermes, but that created even more brand affinity for me. So I absolutely think that storytelling is going to be a big part of how they build, you know, how they build a connection to the next generation. But you're going to find that some brands, no matter how popular that becomes, won't even tell their story. I won't say a brand, but I work for one of them, right? Where it's just like, if you know, you know, and if you love it, you love it. But yeah, absolutely. I see that happening a lot more. But that's a great question.
Perfect answer. You can't say better than that.
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Hi, Viju. I have a question for Viju. I'm still a student, currently finishing my master's fashion in LCF, and I know many people here have more experience, but as a student's point of view, what really makes someone stand out to a company like Richmond, Cartier, like luxury companies to
work for?
Yeah. If this
honestly,
question is appropriate.
I absolutely, of course. You know, I tell this to people all the time, and it's because like I'm spending a lot of time in the boutiques. I'm here because I'm here for work and I'm in the boutiques. And there's something about people always think, oh, working on the shop floor is beneath them. But I tell people, go and work on the shop floor, even while you're getting your master's, because when you go into interview, you have a true point of view. You've engaged with the client. You've seen the product as it really, like a brand comes to life. You can look at something on a shelf and it's pretty. But it comes to life when someone comes in with their life savings and says, I've been saving for 7 years to buy my wife this bracelet, right? Like that is the story behind the why. And that's what you're connecting to. You're selling a dream. But how do you go in and say that you're ready to be a part of that dream selling if you've never really experienced how that dream comes to life for a client. Do you know what I mean? So I absolutely think for you, you might not have time to work on the shop floor, so I get it, but that is my number one advice for people looking to join the business of luxury.
Okay, so before going into the office jobs,
yes,
you can try the retail jobs.
Yeah, and you do first. It while you're in school, right? Because yeah. Again, you'll stand out from someone who has just come from, you know, no experience at all. And it's not hard to get a seasonal job during the holidays, right? We always want someone. Or even now, we're recruiting a lot. And I say we, meaning the luxury sector, from hospitality, because it's the same thing. You go into a Ritz-Carlton, the way that you're made to feel is the same feeling that we want to sell to you when you're buying that next, you know, expensive item. So we're seeing a lot of synergy in industries.
Thank you. My question is also for Bijou. My particular area of interest is authenticity and authentication. And it's also to do with buying things which have a memory. My husband in the early 1990s bought me a Cartier ring, an eternity ring. And I think the value of something is important for memories, but also the value for insurance purposes. Mm-hmm. And I decided it was slightly too large, so I had it altered. And I took it some years ago to be insured. I wanted to get it valued at Cartier. And I discovered that when they had altered the ring, they had removed the identifying number inside. Mm-hmm. And because it was purchased before there was any digital records, there's no way of authenticating it. And obviously I went to the shop, I went to the store with my husband and, you know, we bought the ring together for this occasion. I'm not sure if I have the original receipt, I have the packaging, but there's no way of authenticating it. Yeah. But it's still valuable to me and it's still Cartier to me.
Yeah. And so did you want me to answer that?
And so I would like you to perhaps...
expand a little bit on that.
Shed some light on the fact that there's no way of authenticating items which don't have the...
if we think about just how much... The resale market is huge now, right? Like, so people buy things that 20 other people have bought through. And if we were to take a moment to authenticate, and when I say again, we, I'm speaking in general, every single piece that has gone through, it's really just not profit generating to do that because someone has to sit there and authenticate. And then also the more... fakes there are in the world, the more the need for authentication is. There's a company here that authenticates Hermes bags and they charge you £500 for each. £200, whatever the case is, you then have to pay to prove that your bag is real because of how many fakes there are. So I think the more people get good at duplicating fakes or creating fakes, then the more important authentication becomes. And you bring up a great point of then companies not need to start investing in these sorts of resources to be able to trace their goods, because 30 years from now, we want to be able to say you give it to a family member. We want that family member to come in and know that their, you know, their aunt or their grandma gave them something that was genuinely from the brand. So the point is, brands need to get better at investing in those technologies because there are more fakes and because the resale market is just becoming bigger and bigger as a part of the share of the fashion economy.
Yeah. No, the other thing is that you need to take it back to the place of purchase to have the alteration done, because then they would make, oh, you did. Oh, well, that would be a problem for them then. I'd sue them. I just wanted to ask Sam one question about ingredients. How important are the ingredients in the food you make?
Well, it depends how good the chef is.
Well, no, it's because I was thinking, you know, you get gourmet carrots or Wagyu beef or, you know, kind of supreme or luxury branded food products. So eggs laid by... kind of, I don't know, hens that have been massaged in the Outer Hebrides with Margaret or something. How important are the ingredients?
I mean, of course, if the ingredients aren't good, then you've got nothing. You know, no one wants a rotten plate of food. But at the same time, you know, actually, I'll talk about authenticity as well with this as well, and from a slightly oblique angle rather than a brand angle. But at the same time, we're doing a job for Meta. Our chef spent many thousands of pounds on Wagyu beefs and caviar. It was complete, you know, it's completely unnecessary. They wanted to, like, some freelancers I worked with, they wanted to eat it themselves. It was a good opportunity to put it on a bill. The people from Meta were very pleased with it. But they would have been equally pleased with, you know, very good quality cooking with a good story. The ingredients there were overblown and unnecessary. And it goes to this idea of sort of actual authenticity. I think there was the... you know, we talk a lot about moving away from an age of authenticity. If you experience something and it tastes really, really good, does it need to be authentic Wagyu beef? Not really. It just needs to taste really good and you have a great experience with it. In the same way that, like, this ring gives you terrific value because of the emotional load it has, your experience with it. And that has a value all of itself as well. Like the in social media, we're talking about it. Be Real was all about authenticity in social media. And where is Be Real now? It doesn't exist. No, as it turns out, the people weren't that interested in people's authentic social media stories. They're quite boring. What they wanted was people's manufactured, hyper-real versions of their life. And that's okay too. There's nothing wrong with it.
The dream. People want to buy the dream. They don't want to buy reality. If you have to buy reality, you're just living your own life, right? Like, but people, why do we have influencers? Because you're like, oh my gosh, I want to be on a yacht in Saint-Tropez. You know what I mean? Like, so it's a dream. We're selling a dream at the end of the day. So, yeah.
But we just took a load of influencers on a trip, and they were having a bad time. I was having a bad time because we had this private jet. They all need to get all their content getting on the private jet and setting themselves up. You know, everyone was late, everyone having a bad time, but had this great picture of themselves all getting on this private jet. Would have been much easier just to get on a normal plane like normal people and get on with it. Anyway, authenticity. Sorry, opinions.
No, brilliant. Well, I think that's that was good. I think that's a great way to end the conversation. Thank you to Sam and thank you to Vision.
Thank you.
That wraps up the second half of our conversation with Bijou and Sam, where we've learned that luxury isn't just about diamonds, branding, or even the perfect product. It might just start with a custard cream and end with a story you can't fake. Thanks to Bijou and Sam for joining me. And don't forget to subscribe to the In Pursuit of Luxury podcast for more insightful, unfiltered, and occasionally biscuit-fueled conversations about the evolving world of luxury. I'm Sean Borstrock, and I promise, next time, the biscuits are on me.